We love giving you this podcast for free, and with your help we can keep it free. So how can you help the Rufus Project? Well, first up, try sharing the podcast on social media. Hey, let your friends know about the competitions we run, or even just your favourite bits. You can even review us on iTunes, or just simply give us a bit of feedback through our Facebook, Twitter, Podomatic, or YouTube pages. You know, that's going to make us feel pretty good about giving you this stuff. If you do happen to have a little bit of spare cash around, why not head to therufusproject.podomatic.com and hit the donate button. We are hoping to also set up a bit of a reward scheme for those of you who are generous enough to donate. And finally, if you have a product or service you think may be of interest to the Rufus Project listeners, then please contact us at rufusreviews@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. Now on with the podcast. Hello and welcome to the Rufus Project, your fortnightly guide to geek news, game reviews, movie reviews, cult movies, local events and people, and on the internet we're all local, and whatever else we feel is a good idea at the time. I'm your host Trevor Holland, and in a little while you'll also hear from my good friend and co-host Christian Fletcher. So what wondrous, wondrous treasures do we have in store for you this time around? Well, after the geek news, we're going to go back and have another look at games you must play. I will also be reviewing Sin City, A Dame to Kill For, and you're going to hear Christian talk about the infamous movie studio Troma. In our redeeming features section, we're actually going to visit a classic movie monster who was revisited in the 90s. To mixed results. We've also got a nice list of Christian Fletcher's upcoming events, so definitely listen to that. And of course, competitions where you can win movie tickets. So sit back, relax, and enjoy the podcast. The Australian geek news this last fortnight is again dominated by stuff brought up through the copyright review currently going through the Australian government. And boy, has it brought out the crazies, which you probably can expect. First up, QuickFlix CEO Stephen Langsford has decided that he doesn't like the fact that Australians are accessing Netflix via a VPN service in order to get, well, let's face it, a better, more reliable, and much more varied service at a cheaper price. So how is he going to compete with this? How is he going to deal with this very, very serious situation and very big possible competition to his business? Is he going to look at the content that's available? Is he going to go to the distributors and copyright holders and say, look, Australians are bypassing the content we're making available. You need to give us more stuff and cheaper so that we can pass it on to the consumer? No. No, he thought the best way to deal would be to write a letter to Netflix and make an open letter so that he could post it on the internet as well. And in the letter, he's basically encouraging Netflix to come to Australia through the front door to compete on even ground. He's basically flat out accusing Netflix of knowing that they've got Australian subscribers and in some way encouraging, Netflix is encouraging us to bypass the geo-block restrictions and use VPN services and DNS spoofing services to access their service. No feedback yet as to whether or not this got a reply, but I can just imagine the Netflix CEO being able to turn around and say, well, we looked at our data, and as far as we can tell, there's no data coming from Australia. Because, Stephen Hastings, that's what a VPN does. That's what a DNS spoofer does. It makes whatever you're trying to access think that you're in a country that is able to access that content. Seriously, this letter is just absolute pure posturing. Seriously, look, if you keep this up, I'm going to have to put you in the same camp as Graham Burke, and you don't want to be put in the same camp as Graham Burke. What this does show, of course, is more people are becoming very, very much aware of what VPN services can do, especially when it comes to accessing content that isn't strictly meant to be accessed by you, or at least not through the service that you're going through. And this actually goes beyond Australia. Copyright holders in Australia and the US are currently petitioning Netflix to ban VPN services from accessing their content. Now, Hulu actually does this. If Hulu detects that you're using a VPN service, it will block you, even if you are in the US. It simply says, you're accessing a service via a VPN, we require you to put that to one side and access our service cleanly. They're essentially saying that VPN services are always used for these purposes, which of course is not the case. A lot of businesses use VPNs. It makes it easier for them to do business in other countries. VPNs are also very important when it comes to secure services. The list goes on. And the thing is, though, stopping the VPN service from accessing the service is one thing, okay? It's going to reduce the options. However, there are still the DNS spoofing services, which are completely different and incidentally still let you access services like Hulu in Australia. Just saying. So again, lots of posturing, lots of you must do this rather than what should we do to make people want to access the content legitimately through the legitimate channels. Is it rocket science? No. No, it's not rocket science. Now, of course, if a new study that's been handed down by a Australian government-appointed panel on competition law has its way, then all this posturing and posing and saying VPN is bad may be particularly useless. You see, even though we had a previous review under the prior government, which basically said Australians pay too much for digital and electronic goods, we should allow Australians to use services to circumvent geo-blocks, i.e. VPNs, to get access to cheaper content so we're not ripped off on a global marketplace. Even though that was all there, the current government said, oh no, we better have our own panel. And that panel has pretty much handed down the same outcome. Yep, that's right. The government, which is pushing for tougher anti-piracy laws, is basically doing everything they can to appear to be on the copyright holder side rather than the general public side. Their own panel has said that Australians should be allowed to bypass geo-blocking and geographical restrictions to access content, services, and products more cheaply from overseas. Why are these people not turning around and paying attention to any of this? I don't know. How long can this content industry keep beating its head against the wall before the common sense gets through? I guess we'll probably have to look at this again next fortnight. Of course, the news coming from reviews and various looks at law isn't all rosy. Another thing that is being looked at quite seriously in Australia at the moment is monitoring of the internet, keeping metadata and compulsory metadata retention for everybody. Now, they're saying that, you know, obviously this big bank of metadata, which is going to make everyone's internet bills go up to be kept, can only be accessed through a valid warrant. Sounds good. Except recent proposed changes in security law have actually left a loophole big enough that ASIO, that's the Australian Secret Intelligence Organisation, could actually be given permission to basically have unrestricted monitoring of all internet services from just one warrant application. That's a pretty big loophole, and I'm sure would never be abused if it goes through. But look, seriously, that's enough about the vagaries of Australian law reform when it comes to the internet. Let's have a look at another big story of the past fortnight. I'm sure we all cannot ignore the fact that the iPhone 6 came out. However, there was a consequence that I think a lot of people at Apple and various publicity companies might like to forget. But no, the internet will not let them. You see, on the 20th of September, a celebrity tweeted just how excited they were that they were going to get an iPhone 6. That's all well and good. I'm sure there were plenty of celebrity tweets going around to that effect. The celebrity in question, however, was Joan Rivers, who, if you remember, actually died on the 4th of September. Is this some mysterious tweet from beyond the grave, or is it just some publicity company that had access to Joan Rivers' Twitter account sending out a very unfortunate tweet that had been organised probably far ahead of time? The tweet itself was quickly taken down, but of course not before a number of places got screenshots of it, so it can't be forgotten. Good job, guys. And really, we can't finish off this geek news without wishing, as of the 23rd of September, a happy 125th birthday to the Nintendo Corporation. Obviously most well known today for their series of gaming consoles, but they actually started life as a trading card company way back in 1889. Seriously, whether you're a Nintendo fan or not, you've got to respect a company that makes it to 125 years old. Nintendo, we salute you.
Hello? Anybody?
You need to be quiet.
Who is this?
I'm Clementine. This is my house.
You've been all by yourself through this?
Yeah, I want my parents to come home now.
I think that might be a little while.
You know, when I'm talking about games you must play, it probably would be easier if I talked about standalone ones. But with Portal last time and what I'm talking about this time, it looks like series are the way to go, at least to start with. Well, I guess you're wondering what series I'm talking about. Well, let's just say there's a series that has managed to bring back the adventure game in a big way. Or should I say a publisher? Telltale Games is proving to be quite the aficionado when it comes to bringing the point-and-click adventure game back to the modern audience. And The Shining Light, the absolute pinnacle of their success, would have to be The Walking Dead, which in general is considered probably the best zombie genre story out there at the moment. Unlike the TV series, which is based around the comic, The Walking Dead game instead takes its inspiration from the comic, giving us a whole new original story to work through bit by bit. When the games first started coming out, they were released as episodes, with 5 episodes in each season and a middle episode to sort of bridge the gap between the two. This episodic nature, I guess, in its way, helped keep the interest going throughout the 2 seasons. Basically, it left you wanting more and waiting for the next episode to come out. The quality of the episodes, okay, some were better than others, to be expected. But what was consistent was very good voice performances for the characters within the game and a compelling storyline that kept you moving forward and wanting to know what was going to happen next. Now, I will try to stay away from spoiler territory here, but there will be a few things that I can't avoid mentioning, which also might help you to guess what one or two developments might be. Okay, I apologise in advance if you haven't played these games before, but like I said, I will try to keep it as general as possible. The first season of The Walking Dead game sees you play as Lee, who finds a young girl named Clementine alone in a house in suburbia. Together they go out to try to find Clementine's parents, who had gone off for a holiday, a business holiday. Along the way they meet a cast of characters, including one particular one named Kenny, who we get to meet again in Series 2. And we get to see this relationship between this girl who's all alone and this guy who's all alone. And they do kind of really do make a very good father-daughter dynamic, even though they're not related. Season 2 sees us following through with Clementine's story, seeing who she has become and, more importantly, who she ends up being. But out of all that, I suppose you're asking, what makes The Walking Dead a game you must play? Really, the core of that comes down to the actual emotion that you can feel playing this game. A lot of games go out there trying to get that extra emotional response. In an entertainment medium based a lot on reaction and Twitch gameplay, emotional involvement is often left in the background. But in Telltale's Walking Dead games, they really do push that emotional barometer. You get involved with these characters. There are moments which are genuinely terrifying. There are creep-tastic situations and areas where you just feel your skin crawl. And I am not ashamed to admit it, there may have been a couple of times that left me crying, absolutely distraught at the sheer gut punch rawness of what was happening in front of me. I will say that Season 1, while being slightly less of a technical achievement, probably is stronger when it comes to the emotional response it gets from the players, but Season 2 certainly has its fair share of gut-punch creepy moments and is still well worth playing. The advantage now, of course, that it's all been completed, is that you can pick up Season 1 with the extra DLC episode, which bridges the gap between the two seasons, very, very cheaply. Look, I have seen the entirety for as little as $5. I'm pretty sure if you hang out, you can get it even cheaper. And Season 2, it's done now. Still got a bit of a premium price to it. But again, if you're patient, I'm pretty sure you'll be able to pick up this one quite cheaply come the next round of game sales. The big advantage of this one, of course, though, is it is available on everything. You can get it on PC, it's on PS3, it's on PS Vita, it's on Xbox 360. I've heard there is a PS4 version on the way. Not 100% sure about Xbox One, but it wouldn't surprise me. And it's also available on iOS and Android. So, for a compelling adventure game experience that really gives you that emotional involvement and, let's face it, basically kicks you in the guts and punches you in the feels, which, again, is probably the greatest achievement of this game series. The Walking Dead Season 1 and Season 2 are definitely up there amongst the games you must play.
They are weak and we are strong. It's why it falls to people like us to lead them to safety.
I'm not like you.
Yeah,
this podcast, I'm going to look at a subgenre of film that is completely a category of its own. The trauma movie. Titles like Poultrygeist, Night of the Chicken Dead, Redneck Zombies, Toxic Avenger, Class of Newcombe High. You may have heard of these names. They may sound like the lowest of low. Well, they are. But ladies and gentlemen, this is a trauma film, and today I will be looking at the history of trauma and what it has gone on to become. Troma started as a film company by Lloyd Kaufman and Michael Hertz in the early 70s. What started as a film production company has also gone on to become an infamous distributor of cult movies as well. Titles that wouldn't necessarily have been a Troma title have now been released by the company and seem to fit so well. I think Wikipedia sums it up well. Troma movies are low-budget independent movies which play on elements of 1950s horror and farce. Now, these movies are the lowest of low, and Lloyd Kaufman, the creator of Troma, would agree with me. We actually considered a Troma movie for this podcast's redeeming features, but felt that it was very much beneath it, beyond analysis. These are the ultimate Z movies, and this is what they're supposed to be. Having started off in the 70s, Troma first released a couple of sex comedies throughout the 70s, I believe 1971 and 1979, but it wasn't until the character Toxie and the movie Toxic Avenger came along to steer them in the right direction of horror. Troma had a hit with Toxic Avenger in 1985, and it was interesting how it used a violent, dark sort of, you know, black comedy whilst also posing as a mainstream horror film. Virtually ignored when it came out in 1985, it took a while for Toxic Avenger to catch on. It became a long and successful midnight movie in, I believe, New York City in late 1985, and that's where it sort of grew. And remember too, this was coming out at a time when VHS was having a boom, so it would have also generated a lot of interest at the video store as well. Toxic Avenger went on to become Troma's most popular film. It actually spawned sequels and even a short-lived, or I believe axed, animated television program. But unfortunately, with a lot of the financial dilemmas that were happening with the company, the sequels to the films were often box office bombs, and the cartoon adaptation quickly ended. The Toxic Avenger character, known as Toxie, is now Troma's official mascot. But what happened in the subsequent years? With all these financial troubles, they just weren't able to find another hit. The only thing that followed very similarly was Class of Newcombe High in 1987. This was very similar to the success that they had with Toxic Avenger. However, the sequels to this never lived up to the expectations either. Maybe Troma just needed to stick with one concept only and not try to make sequels. It was then that they started to go into distribution. When they found it hard to re-enter the mainstream market with their finances dwindling, as they were going into the 90s, they turned to distributing other people's movies. Now, as mentioned before, these movies weren't necessarily Troma Entertainment movies, but under the Troma banner, you wouldn't think any differently. Gosh, did they fit. You know, movies like Rabid Grannies, you know, a film from Belgium. Killer Condom, a German film that verges on softcore porn, but is so up there with being a Troma-type film. Then there's the infamous Cannibal the Musical from 1993. Now, this was created by, at the time, a little-known Trey Parker and Matt Stone. This movie musical was an American feature, however, being released under the Troma banner brought it to a wider audience. Throughout the 90s and into the noughties, Kaufman directed three more independent features, including such titles as Tromeo and Juliet, which has gone on to become one of their infamous titles. Into 2014, there's still lots of news bubbling under the surface. A remake of The Toxic Avenger is apparently in the works. There has been talk of this for a while. Even names like Arnold Schwarzenegger have been linked to it as well. Apparently, there's been interest from director Steve Pink, who did Hot Tub Time Machine, to co-write and direct this remake. However, they're aiming for a PG rating, so don't expect a very gory X-rated version of The Toxic Avenger that we're familiar with in the 80s. And did you know, Toxic Avenger the musical now exists off-Broadway? I wonder if that will make its way down under anytime soon. On Thursday the 9th of October at New Globe Theatre in the Valley, we're bringing The Toxic Avenger back on the big screen, digitally remastered, for its 30th anniversary. The screening is taking place at 6:30 p.m. and tickets are available for $10 per person at the door. This is definitely an 18-plus event, and we look forward to seeing you there as we relive what started the whole Troma story, the film that Lloyd Kaufman calls the movie that built Troma. See you on the 9th of October.
Meet little Melvin. He's a 90-pound weakling. Everyone hated Melvin.
I'm gonna take this mop and shove it down your throat.
They teased him.
I wanna do it with you.
Okay.
They taunted him. They tormented him until he had a horrifying accident and fell into a vat of nuclear waste, transforming little Melvin into a hideously deformed creature of superhuman size and strength. Melvin became the Toxic Avenger, the first superhero born out of nuclear waste.
Sin City's where you go in with your eyes open, or you don't come out at all.
Sin City, A Dame for Kill For is a sequel to the original Sin City made back in 2005. That's quite a while between movies. Normally the sequels come a bit faster. The original Sin City actually got quite a bit of praise for its very distinct visual style, based as it is on a series of novels by Frank Miller, a very prolific artist with a very unique style indeed, and was essentially a combination of different stories intertwining and were basically complementing each other. But again, it makes you wonder why such a movie that did have quite a bit of success, had an ensemble cast, and really did grab everyone's attention at the time, why would that take so long for the sequel to come about? And more importantly, how does Sin City, A Dame to Kill For compare both to the original and to, I suppose, what else is available to us now? Well, first up, it definitely keeps the same visual style. However, while that felt fresh in the first movie, it doesn't seem to work quite as well here. I don't know if it's just that they've tried to be more gratuitous with the violence, there is some very gratuitous violence in this, or if it's just that, yes, the first time we saw it was impressive, second time, not so much. Not too sure on that, but for some reason, the visuals, while striking and having some standout moments, don't seem to quite carry over into this newer version. We again have intertwining stories, but again in this new version, they don't seem to gel as well. They do seem to be very separate stories rather than ones that particularly overlap. There is a little bit here, there, a couple of characters that appear in different stories, but it doesn't feel cohesive. There is definitely a lack of continuity throughout. They do, like, go back to particular areas and particular locations, but it just seems more coincidence than some sort of grand design. So unfortunately, when it comes to the story and the cohesiveness, the new SimCity, again, just can't quite match the scope of its predecessor. I suppose if the stories themselves are fantastic, that mightn't be too much of a problem, but again, the individual stories don't have that much to them, and generally is person goes from point A to point B, something very violent happens, lots of people die. Performer-wise, there's a bit of a mix. We do have a number of actors coming back reprising their roles. You have Mickey Rourke, who actually looks less freaky or made up as the square-jawed Marv than he does in real life. Bruce Willis does have a return role, but doesn't really do much to it. Probably one of the least involving characters in the entire movie, and ties in a lot with Jessica Alba's story, who again just really doesn't seem to bring much to the movie. Eva Green manages to vamp it up quite a bit in the main story, the Dame to Kill For story. Incidentally, she also spends most of that story stark naked, so there is something there, I guess. And again, because A Dame to Kill For is the main story, the actual title story, it does get the most attention and feels like the most cohesive of all the stories. Most of the main players from the other stories also make an appearance in this feature one, but again, it just seems more coincidental rather than something which is part of a grand design. Probably the other performance of note would have to be Joseph Gordon-Levitt's performance as Johnny, a gambler hitting Sin City, and let's just say running into a few problems along the way. they do spend a lot of time focusing on this particular character, and Joseph Gordon-Levitt carries it really, really well. I'd pretty much say that he is the best performer in the movie, so it's probably a little less fortunate that he didn't get more of a feature role. But still, if you're a fan of over-the-top action, hyper-stylized visuals, and many, many scantily clad, if clad at all, female bodies, then SimCity A Dame to Kill For certainly has plenty to provide on that side of things. If you're after an engaging series of plots entwining together, building a big picture, then you're gonna really find yourself let down with this particular sequel, and you're probably better off going back to the original. At the end of the day, I'm afraid that Sin City, A Dame to Kill For, is more like Sin City, A Bit of a Disappointment.
Power is a fragile thing. I need them to know the price of defiance. Now, who wants to play?
Boy? Oh boy.
You know, one thing I love about the redeeming features is really, there's not really any shortage of titles for us to look at. There are so many dodgy movies out there, it's like a buffet, a smorgasbord every single time. However, I thought we'd maybe tie into something which links to more recent movies, and with Godzilla currently stomping around the screens in 2014, what better time is there than now to go back to 1998 for the Godzilla movie that featured Matthew Broderick, of all people, Ferris Bueller, in the main role. Now, I probably can't tell you too much about this movie. I'm afraid I'm not too much of an expert on this one, and neither is Christian. But we did both sit down and watch through it to let you know what the redeeming features are. So, Christian, how are you?
I'm great, thank you, Trevor. But, gosh, I honestly feel like that 2 hours and 18 minutes of Godzilla is still going. It felt so long. I feel like, I'm to be honest to our listeners, I'm fresh from having watched the end of it, so I'm still kind of reeling from what really just happened. So yeah, I'll be interested to see on what you think, Trevor, because you know I'm coming at this completely, you know, almost completely, you know, not knowing anything about Godzilla. You know, I did see the recent, you know, the 2014 remake, adaptation, whatever you want to call it, in the cinemas, and that's probably my only real basis of knowing much about Godzilla, and of course the plastic-like dinosaur going rah across screens in the 50s and 60s, you know, shots of that, but I haven't necessarily seen the full movies, and I think being a monster movie fan, possibly I should be delving into that a bit more, but that's another story. But I was quite intrigued to sort of not compare it, but see, you know, look, I was very disappointed with the recent movie, to be honest. I felt that, you know, it just didn't have much substance. It just felt like Godzilla was chasing all these big parasites, and it really should have just been Parasite, the movie. Godzilla didn't really make sort of an appearance until sort of the latter half. And, yeah, I won't ruin it for anyone. I know Trevor hasn't seen it himself too, so I'd be interested to see what you think another time. But so I'm going really off that. And, yeah, I was just quite disappointed with it overall. So I was thinking, you know, actually at the time of seeing it with friends, I actually said, you know, oh, wow, it's probably time to go back and watch the 1998 one. And I never quite got around to it until Trevor suggested it for redeeming features. So so I finally got to compare the two and experience this 1998 Matthew Broderick vehicle, if you could call it that.
Yeah, I'm not sure if he would consider it a major vehicle in his career.
I'm sure it's not high on his resume, let's just say. I'm sure Ferris Bueller's still very much, you know, in the lead.
Absolutely. In fact, I probably will address this straight up with regards to Matthew Broderick and his character, Dr. Nico Tatopoulos. And early on, there's this running gag where no one can pronounce his name. I don't know how many times I do this gag. It happens over and over and over again. But to simplify things, I think from now on, anytime we refer to Matthew Broderick, we should just call him Ferris.
Oh, good idea. Do they purposely give him names that can't be pronounced so people will just go Ferris, possibly?
is, you know, if you're talking Matthew Broderick, you've always got to celebrate Ferris.
Oh, look, you can hardly... Look, I can't see him playing anything else. To me, he's, you know, even in this, he's an adult Ferris trying to combat Godzilla or Zillas or whatever, you know, where we're talking about. But
And also another thing that definitely must be mentioned, especially with some of my redeeming features, not too sure about Christian's, but the genuine redeeming features are going to have to drop spoilers. So I just want to warn you now. There's no way I can talk about the aspects that I actually do genuinely consider good about this movie without dropping spoilers. So
now, Trevor, can I just say that you've actually taken a weight off my mind, because a couple of my one of my redeeming features was actually possibly going to be a spoiler as well. So you've sort of put my mind at ease. But let's just say in terms of Godzilla, or if you're thinking of those type of movies, the ending is possibly inevitable, especially in a mainstream Hollywood movie. Maybe I could say that. So that's it's quite predictable. So I don't think we're going to ruin too much towards, you know, possibly the ending. But what leads up to that is another story. So
sure thing. One thing that I think it is quite interesting from this. It's very much, if you are a long-term Godzilla fan of the earlier ones, or even the most recent one, because I do know it does have its supporters, you're going to probably find this one pretty, well, on one hand, it's pretty lightweight, but on the other hand, it's very heavy-handed. It certainly is something where, from the outset, it's just like, nuclear testing equals bad. And look at these poor lizards. Look at these poor lizards looking at the nuclear testing. Look how bad it is.
Yeah.
It's like, we get it, you know. We do get it.
Doing it like that, it did, you know, as you said, with all this destruction, it felt so much to me like an old-school monster movie, like from the 50s, where you had people running through a town and it's being just destroyed, you know. And it's funny how they always seem to be in places like New York, for example, because they have so much population, it seems the best place for it to happen. So it felt like it was harping back a bit to the old-school, you know, let's just go in there and make this death and destruction monster movie, let's not hold back. And yeah, it was quite, dare I say, ferocious, I suppose, in some respects, and almost not what I was used to with Godzilla, especially in comparison to the new one, who, you know, as I said, fights parasites. So, you know, how I interpret the legend is, you know, he comes out from, you know, the sea to save humans from, you know, things that are attacking them, and that's sort of the whole Godzilla story. So really, this 1998 one does not really fit into that at all. Hence, I suppose, the term Zilla, which has been thrown around a bit, especially in any research that I did do of the movie, which is the fact that, you know, Toho, who, you know, had the original Godzilla trademark, have actually had turned around and gone, gosh, this is so not Godzilla, you've changed the monster so much. So they trademarked the term Zilla, which, I don't know, correct me if I'm wrong, is that term actually used in the movie? I can't actually remember.
No, they pretty much refer to the monster as Godzilla, but they make a bit of a gag of it. There's a particular character, a fairly obnoxious news broadcaster, who's a thorn in the side of the female lead. Not that you really care. I mean, this female lead, I've got no sympathy for her.
Even calling her that seems like a bit of a, I don't know, a waste of air.
yeah. Well, I guess, well, she was an airhead. But
she was thrown in for good measure, let's just say. They needed to have some sort of female interest. They didn't want to have Matthew Broderick opposite Godzilla. You know, it doesn't look too good, even though you don't go to Godzilla for a romance story.
No.
Anyway.
It may have been a better movie, though.
Yes. They could have done what they did with Titanic, had all the love stuff at the start and then the destruction start.
Yeah,
possibly.
True. But there's one bit where they find this videotape of this one survivor from a boat that gets destroyed by Godzilla, which incidentally just seems to appear in the middle of a tropical island fully grown. No one notices it. There's suddenly, oh, look, there's big footprints here in the middle of this island that just have suddenly appeared. It goes and pretty much tears a ship apart in the middle of the ocean, but that ship still makes it to shore with one lone survivor. And he's saying what it is, you know, referring to the Japanese. I can't, I would butcher the pronunciation, to be honest. And then along comes this newscaster who coins the Godzilla name within this movie. And I'm going to call Matthew Broderick Ferris. I'm just going to call Audrey Timmons was her name. I'm just going to call her Airhead.
Okay.
So an airhead is in the background just mumbling, oh, it's not that. It's... Yeah, whatever.
And you do that so well.
Whatever, I don't care what you say. Sorry, this woman frustrated me so much in this movie.
I just apologise if she is listening, if she has by some freak chance tuned in, or that's probably not the right term, is listening to the podcast. Please get in touch, tell us what you think of the film.
Are you just as ashamed of it as we think you should be?
Is this the reason why your career has not blossomed? Okay, back to, sorry.
Anyway, sorry.
Tangent.
Was that redeeming features? Yeah, better get back on that.
Finding the redeeming ones are a little hard, though.
Yeah. Well, let's keep talking actors then. Within this, Ferris, he kind of just hangs around, looks around, and is there to make the discoveries and be smart. I actually did get the feeling that with the head of that science team they put together, the lady scientist, I can't remember her name offhand, because she barely appears. But I do get the feeling that there may have been the intention to put, like, her in as a secondary love interest for the love triangle.
Well, it was interesting, It almost felt like they were starting to make her the love interest, and then it just went nowhere. It just became purely business, you know, if it is the woman I'm thinking of. Yeah. So, yeah, it was quite strange. So maybe they've gone, or we'll fall back on this option if the first one doesn't work. Or maybe halfway through shooting they realised she was an airhead.
Who knows? But I would have liked to see more of that character. She seemed like a much more interesting, involved, and much more of a character that you could
ballsier, yeah, with something to give Ferris a bit of a run for his money, I think.
But, yeah, unfortunately, she disappears quite fast and then is suddenly there at the end again.
But, it is interesting. Look, it's funny with this movie. I actually felt, probably about 10 or 15 minutes into it, I'm going, God, it takes a while to get into it. You know, they're setting up all these different things and a lot of it confusing, starting with obviously the lizards and everything. Not saying that was confusing, but, all the things that they were throwing in. And then I'm thinking, God, this is taking a while to build, to get into it a bit more. And then all of a sudden, Godzilla appears, and it's almost 20 minutes in, you're thinking, okay, what are they going to do for the next 2 hours of this film? I don't know. I think like that when I'm, when I'm looking at the length of a film, for example, or watching one. It even felt to me a bit like it was two movies in one. Not saying two totally different movies or two separate movies. It almost felt like part one and part two. You had the whole build-up and Godzilla attacking, and then what they felt was the breakdown, the death or destruction of Godzilla, but they were soon to be fooled. And the second story felt like, I don't know, another installment of Jurassic Park, because you were dealing with the younger, all the eggs hatching, from Godzilla. But was it just me, or even though, they did grow up to be like these iguana-like creatures, did you feel that as young they just felt like, you're watching Jurassic Park?
Yeah, I did. And interestingly enough, when that bit came in, that's probably where I really started enjoying the movie. This is like jumping right forward. Such a good formula. Like, obviously, Godzilla being this giant creature, it's got to be running around the streets and it's all very open and things being destroyed along the way. But then, essentially, we get baby Godzillas. Straight up. Yep. They can't talk about this without saying it straight up, okay? There's baby Godzillas that hatch in Madison Square Gardens, yep. I believe.
Yeah.
And you end up with this claustrophobic corridor chase as they're trying to find the way out and avoid these lizards. There's meant to be like 200 of them, basically.
And they're not like they're just babies that are hatched that are just kind of just standing there going, ma, 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 or anything like that. These are pretty ferocious.
That's right. They like fish. And throughout the adventures of discovering this nest of eggs, everyone gets covered in fish. So I'm pretty sure you can use imagination. And it's a tried and true formula when you think about it. It's that claustrophobic chase scene. It's that tension. And you really, that is when you really get into this movie. Just, it's such a shame it takes so long to get there.
Yeah, that's the thing. But as I said, it did feel like two movies. They kind of did the whole Godzilla thing and then thankfully did the second bit because, that sort of, it got your interest back in again. And it was interesting actually, coming back to sort of how they tried to build a human interest element into it. And, it felt like, even with the love stories and things like that, they'd pretty much try to start to build it up. all the Godzilla stuff happened. They've decided to have all the stuff with the, you know, the baby Godzillas. And then, you know, this isn't going to spoil anything, but at the end, trying to sort of resolve all the love interest too, which really had never gone anywhere. Throughout the middle, nothing had really happened. But there's a couple of awkward scenes with a few people hugging and people kissing and confessing their undying love. This isn't the main characters, which kind of makes you scratch your head and go, do we really care?
Pretty much. Well, maybe if you had shown more of those characters throughout the movie, we'd be compelled.
Oh, but then, as I said earlier, people go to these movies for the monster. You know, they don't really go for the human thing. But when the human element does work, it works. It's great. It's great when they can get the combination of the two. And I felt even that with the newer movie too. They had these big names in it, but they were, you know, 20 minutes in, you know, forgotten all about them. They had no real story, and it was just concentrating on Godzilla and the parasites for the next hour and a half. But, you know, I don't know if this is me sort of dipping into the redeeming features, but it did have, you know, I don't know if, you know, if I'm, you know, going to be spoiling things by going in towards the end, but it did have a very human part to it where you did actually sort of feel this sadness. And a very relatable thing, because one interesting thing about these, especially even with the 50s monster movies and any monster movie, it's always they want to shoot them down. They never really want to try and understand the monster. They always just want to go straight in for the attack, you know. And, you know, it's good when they have moments when you start to go, wow, this monster has feelings too. I know that sounds weird. But
I know,
it is interesting,
yeah.
And they do, and there is a scene at the end of the movie where you do actually go, oh, wow.
Yeah,
and it kind of leaves you a bit kind of gutted, you know, which is what the feeling you're supposed to have, and almost not a feeling you'd expect from a movie that you've just watched.
Yeah, I did see that one as well. This poignant moment where Ferris is looking at the defeated Godzilla, and it's all very quiet, and Airhead Bimbo comes into the background and very solemn and serene. It would have been quite poetic if it didn't immediately cut to everybody else in the movie going, woo, it's dead!
Yeah, it took off any sort of emotional feeling. You know, they could have even gone with an idea of having them all walk away with silence, and that was the end of the movie, kind of leaving it up in the air. But no, it's a Hollywood mainstream movie. It needs to have cheering, and we've slayed the dragon.
Yeah. I tell you what, with the cheering, with the celebrating, and this is certainly something that I want to mention, I don't know why the military guys were celebrating. If you want to see the most useless depiction of the military ever, see this movie. Seriously, the army does more damage to New York than Godzilla ever does. And they keep cutting to this guy who's in charge on the ground in New York, and he's completely useless. He's completely undecisive. He just spends most of the movie being completely perplexed. And at the end, the big boss in the base camp is going, good job, soldier! And you're thinking, why are you thanking him? He was useless!
I know, but of course it always has to come down to the human that did it, you know, or these humans, you know, solve the problem. But yeah, no, ridiculous.
I mean, the cameraman played by Harry Shearer, and I do actually have Harry Shearer as one of my redeeming features because he was one of the better actors in this movie.
Oh, it's funny. I don't know. Every time he walked into shot, I half expected him to have a cucumber down his pants and, you know, getting, you know, like the scene from Spinal Tap. That's all I can think of.
Well, I mean, I actually think of him more as the Blue Raja from Mystery Men. And he's going to start flinging forks at Godzilla. Okay, here's a fun thing. I just saw that redeeming feature right now. Picture Harry Shearer coming on as one of his characters from another movie, and I think you would have quite a good time watching this.
Oh, and then you'd be waiting for him the whole time to pop up, because he does. He pops up in all these different parts, and you're not knowing when he's going to come in again. And that would have been a perfect way to save the movie. God, they really need to do a director's cut.
Yes.
Or a Harry Shearer cut. Yes. A Sean edition, Harry Shearer.
Harry Shearer is Hank Azaria. Oh, God. It was Hank Azaria, sorry, not Harry Shearer.
Yeah.
Oh, Hank Azaria.
No,
Harry Shearer and Hank Azaria are both in it.
Yeah, they're both in it, yes. No, I'm thinking of Harry Shearer.
Yep.
And I hope that's what we were talking about.
I was actually preferring more to Hank Azaria. Oh, my goodness.
But I did enjoy having Harry Shearer in it, seeing him pop up. You know, as I said, it felt very Spinal Tap. And see, not being familiar with Mystery Men, I wasn't aware that Hank Azaria was in that one. So,
yeah.
Or we're confusing it even more now.
I think we're confusing it. Essentially, Harry Shearer and Hank Azaria are both very good in this movie, even if you don't imagine them as other characters they played.
Yeah, and they are definitely some redeeming features. I would definitely agree with that one. But I even like that, just on a side note here, one of the characters goes, "We're going to need a bigger gun." You know, they always have to throw in a reference to Jaws, and any sort of monster movie, they have to do something like that. So I don't know if it was... It makes me think, was the movie done very tongue-in-cheek? But, you know, I get the feeling, because it was so heavy-handed, that no, they were hoping this would revitalize the genre, which I don't know how long it had been dormant for. But I know that, you know, Toho Company, as I mentioned earlier, were not very happy with it at all and distanced itself. And you can understand why. The Godzilla character shown does not look like the one that you're very familiar with. It is very dinosaur-esque. It could almost have been, another installment of Jurassic Park. Easy. Especially the second half.
Yeah, well, again, and that second half is really where most of my actual redeeming features are focused on.
Yeah, it just picked up so much more. Like, I just felt the first half just wasn't exciting. It just felt, okay, you know, it's just moving through it, yep. And then, yeah, it didn't really pick up until the second half.
But things to look out for. There are a few little things to look out for. First of all, you've got probably the only scene where the hero is saved from the marauding monsters by gumballs.
Oh, yeah, and they were quite effective too. I didn't think they'd be as effective as they were.
and our good friend Airhead Bimbo has probably one of the finest and most 90s lines, even though it was late 90s. They're in this studio in Madison Square Garden, and they're trapped wondering what to do, and they decide to do a news broadcast. She is a reporter, apparently. Hank Azaria, the cameraman, is there. And she says that, "Oh, it's okay. We're connected to the main studio by an internet."
I noticed that too. Oh, gosh. Showing its age, isn't it? Oh, but even that turn. It did feel so nice. And even just what she was wearing, you know, always just reeked of it to me. But I don't know if it was a drawback, actually. I know we're supposed to be looking at redeeming features, but just a quick comment. I felt possibly they showed Godzilla too much, or, you know, or the Zillas, or whatever you want to call them, or any of the creatures in the movie. And I think a lot of the mystery in a lot of the older monster movies, and what kind of, you know, kept it kind of exciting, was they didn't show too much of it. They kind of kept you guessing. And whereas I felt there was too much of, you know, close-up shots and full-frame shots of Godzilla, and it was really possibly them going, "Hey, look at this special effects budget we've got. We're going to use every cent." It was obviously model work, but it was very well done, and definitely, you know, branching off, you know, segueing into my redeeming features, the special effects were very good, I must admit, you know, considering, dare I say it, considering the time it came out. But, you know, I think, you know, not that I really have much to compare with, not being, you know, I suppose, what do we have around that time? Independence Day, and, yeah, I suppose it was very, you know, very much of its time, but, again, showed Godzilla a bit too much, you know, didn't really have that mystery.
So, like, built up the mystery, and then suddenly, here's Godzilla, and you couldn't get away from it.
And the whole time I'm waiting for us to realise, oh, no, it's not the real Godzilla, and then have this other one come in, very similar to the rubber one. The old school one, not necessarily looking that tacky, but something, I was waiting for something else to happen, because it just wasn't living up to what pop culture had really told me Godzilla was all about. So, you know, if I'd gone into that film, you know, well, I did go into it, you know, not knowing anything, but having seen it, you know, when it first came out, I would have come out of the cinema scratching my head going, you know, oh, I didn't really, you know, feel like what I thought it was going to. But not giving away, you know, not doing another spoiler, let's just say, you know, it's almost setting itself up for a sequel at the end, if you know what I mean, with that last shot.
Of course, there's a compulsory sequel teaser.
Oh, exactly.
Is there a movie in the 90s that didn't have a compulsory sequel teaser?
Yeah, just one, like, God, because Godzilla just, to me, reeks of merchandise tie-ins, and I believe they had so much, they had, you know, things with Hungry Jacks and Macca's and all those places, you know, and I do actually remember, you know, in 1998 seeing the merchandise around, so I was aware of its release, and it was quite hyped, but not hyped enough for me to pay the $10 and go and see it.
Sure.
I'm kind of glad I didn't, but yeah. I wouldn't be thinking that those many years ago that I'd be trying to redeem it, let's just say.
I do know, and don't ask me for too many details, but it also spawned a spin-off cartoon series.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
So was it you? Did you know if it used any of the sort of characters aside from Godzilla?
Well, for some, yeah. Yeah, there was Godzilla, and for some reason, Godzilla could be controlled by this team of jocks with the compulsory bimbo airhead along. They fought crime and save people from disasters by calling up the G-Man, as they refer to Godzilla. So very, very 90s.
Oh, gosh. I hope that this has died, but it probably exists out there somewhere on the internet.
I'm sure you can find it on YouTube. I'm endorsing looking that up on YouTube.
Yeah, not that I'm endorsing myself to even watch it. But yeah, interesting overall. So redeeming features, definitely sounds like, from your point of view, aside from Airhead, the cast was notable. You know, those big names, and, you know, we've got Harry and Hank or whoever we think we're talking about. I enjoyed their cameos. I think it's a bit of an insult to say cameos. They did appear a lot more in them. So they were good in it. And, you know, it was good to be, you know, even though he didn't necessarily suit the role, it was good seeing Matthew Broderick in a mainstream film at this period. It would have been supposedly good for his career, but, you know, the end result, possibly not. At the time, it would have looked to have been a possibly resurgence for him, but not to be.
I guess I were trying for that. But one last thing I want to mention is even though the closeout song when the credits start is probably one of the most horrible things you could ever do to a Led Zeppelin song. It's probably the only song in history where the rude words are edited out with a Godzilla roar.
Oh, yeah. Hey, at least it's tongue-in-cheek.
Very much. I was listening thinking, oh, like, there's a couple of rules, and then it actually dawned on me that the fact that this rule was replacing, the occasional F-bomb done by P. Diddy in this
and of course,
horrible, horrible song.
But talking about, you know, things being very 90s, wasn't it almost essential for any kind of movie like this, any kind of spin-off, to have a soundtrack by a rapper of some description? So
yes.
I don't bat an eyelid.
No.
But definitely, you know, redeeming features, cast, you know, not the final song. Special effects, to me, I still think were good. They did show Godzilla a bit too much. And definitely, you know, I know we have kind of spoiled it a bit, but the human interest angle at the end, you know, the very poignant moment to me kind of made having sat through a lot of it very worthwhile. It's just a shame they ruined it with the cheers straight after.
And of course, the baby Godzilla section.
Oh, that was, yeah, it was frightening. You were thinking, how are you going to get past? Because, you know, they were snapping.
Yep, they were snapping, they were chasing, and I felt like I had this brief moment of feeling that I was actually watching a decent movie.
Yeah, and I felt that actually when I was starting to watch it, I'm thinking, ooh, you know, especially when they start with that scene of the iguanas on the, you know, looking at the nuclear stuff in the distance, you're like, yep, okay, cool, I'm getting the story, you'll get straight into it, you'll be a great movie. And you're thinking it's going to become this, and it just got bogged down in trying to create stories that just didn't go anywhere. So really, I suppose for the listener here, they want to go and see Godzilla, which we're 50-50 encouraging you to see it. I'd say don't give up halfway through, because it's going to pick up again about halfway, you know, especially when the baby Godzillas come in.
If you see it through, there's definitely worth in this movie.
And if you are a fan of 50s B-grade Attack of the Killer, you know, whatever, you know, you'll probably still enjoy it. You know, it's formula, you know, and the concept of it, you know, it's just, but even like with those older movies, you know, you don't go for the human interest and you know, or the human angle, and it's not usually that good. So, you know, but I suppose, like you said earlier, if you're a diehard Godzilla fan, it might leave you with a very bad taste in your mouth.
And of course, look, we want to know what you guys out there think. So if you have seen the 1998 Ferris vs. Godzilla movie, we'd love to hear your thoughts, and especially if you watch it with this redeeming feature section in mind, we definitely want to hear from you about what you thought of the movie and what you thought of us for suggesting that you watch it. And of course, if you have a movie that you think is irredeemable, I can guarantee you I don't think there's a movie out there worse than Blood Rain. I'm willing to be proven wrong. So send in your suggestions and send in your challenges. We want to hear them.
Sounds like a plan, even though I'm kind of hoping people don't, if you know what I mean. But I'm up for the challenge after some of the things we've had to watch. But they haven't been too bad. Yeah. But I am waiting for the worst one to appear.
I keep debating whether I should make you watch one of the Blood Rain sequels. Possibly. Because you missed out on Blood Rain.
The fact that you said sequel with a plural kind of scares me, that there's actually more than one sequel of that in existence.
Yeah, I think it's a sign of great evil at work in the world. That
definitely. No, I think you making me watch it is the sign of great evil as well.
Oh, yeah.
Forward to seeing what the next redeeming feature is. Redeeming features movie is.
We have to make it a good one. Awesome. Oh. Thank you, Christian. As always, this is so much fun.
Oh, no worries. I always enjoy hearing your side of the story and seeing what we can come up with, to be honest.
Excellent. Okay, well.
happy viewing. I look forward to hearing from all the Godzilla viewers.
As we head into October, it's time to look at some of my upcoming events. As we all know, it's school holidays at the moment, and if you're looking for a classic family-orientated movie that you can take the kids to, why not check out our school holiday program at New Globe Theatre, Fortitude Valley. Kicking off on Saturday the 27th of September with the Disney classic Little Mermaid at 3 p.m. On Sunday the 28th, if you're looking for more of a movie for the teens, why not head to a screening of the 1983 Ozploitation classic BMX Bandits, starring a very young Nicole Kidman. The program continues and rounds up on Wednesday the 1st of October with a screening of the Disney classic The Lion King at 6:30 p.m. So as mentioned, these are taking place at New Globe Theatre, Fortitude Valley. All tickets are $10 and tickets are available at the door. It'll be a chance for you to relive these classics on the big screen with your kids. For the first Wednesday of the month, on Wednesday the 1st of October, we're screening the Roger Corman 1975 cult classic Hollywood Boulevard, a 70s drive-in exploitation spoof. Don't miss your chance of seeing this rare Roger Corman movie from the mid-70s. This is happening at Room 60, Kelvin Grove, Urban Village. Arrive early for drinks and food, and the screening is taking place at 6:30. Tickets are only $5 or $10, and your first drink is free. Why not give it a go and experience a rarer cult classic with a group of friends in a really relaxed, cozy atmosphere such as Room 60? As mentioned earlier in the podcast, we've got the 1984 trauma classic The Toxic Avenger screening for its 30th anniversary on Thursday the 9th of October at New Globe Theatre. Tickets are $10 per person at the door, and this is an 18-plus screening, definitely. Screening fully uncut and uncensored on the big screen. Don't miss seeing this infamous cult classic. Can't get enough of my 80s nights? Well, on Saturday the 18th of October, we're kicking it off with another installment of Tracks, with DJs Missy Boots and Lisa Electro taking you to a bit of a darker side of the 80s, playing some of your favourite hits, plus some of those songs you think, wow, I haven't heard that for a while. Entry is free, and this takes place upstairs at the Port Office Hotel, 40 Edward Street, Brisbane City. I look forward to seeing you there, in costume too. Keep a lookout in upcoming weeks as I'm going to launch my Halloween movie program. Over 2 weeks at venues across Brisbane, I'll be screening the best and the worst and some of the most unseen horror classics of all time. For full details about upcoming events, find me on Facebook, Christian Fletcher, or www.christianfletcher.com.
Now, where would the Rufus Project be if we didn't have a competition about something we talked about earlier in the podcast? And of course, this podcast, there is no exception. For a very lovely double pass, you have got the chance to see The Toxic Avenger on the big screen for its special 30th anniversary screening. This is at the Globe Theatre on Thursday the 9th of October. Screening starts at 6:30 p.m. And as mentioned earlier, this is definitely an 18 plus event. Okay, so sorry kids, you're going to have to wait before you see this movie. But I guess enough waffling on about that. How do you win this? Well, it's quite simple. simply leave the comment Melvin in any of the usual places, which, if you don't know what the usual places are, I will be listing at the end of this podcast. So simple, so easy. Enter this competition and hopefully we'll see you at the New Globe Theatre for the 30th anniversary screening of The Toxic Avenger. Thanks so much for listening to The Rufus Project. We hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as we enjoyed putting it together. Now, if you would like to leave some comments, some feedback, requests, suggestions, the list goes on, or even if you, you know, maybe want to win those Toxic Avenger tickets, super duper simple. Simply leave a comment on our YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, Podomatic, Ustream pages. Just search for The Rufus Project on any of those places and you'll find us easily enough. Or you can head to our homepage at therufusproject.podomatic.com. If you are someone or you have something that you think might be suitable to feature in our local wildlife section, then we want to hear from you as well. All those previous contact methods are still perfectly valid, but if you want to be a bit more private about it, you can shoot us an email at rufusreviews@gmail.com. Also, we want you to give us sign-outs for this very podcast. Now, I've done a few of the last few weeks. I don't have one this week, but still, definitely get those suggestions in. You know, I love reading out what other people come up with. I don't know. It's just a thing I like. Okay? Don't judge me. Please, don't judge me. So, while waiting for another one to come through, until next time, I couldn't think of a witty sign out, so feel free to add your own. See you next time. If ASIO does get unrestricted access to monitor pretty much everything on the internet, then I think there's only one thing I can say about that. Hi ASIO, you guys are great. Yeah, I love you guys. You're awesome. Please don't hurt me.